The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. The president brokers a major peace accord in the Middle East.
Peace through strength works. It always has. It did from Roman times on. Ronald Reagan brought it back into fashion here. President Trump, after 8 years of leading from behind.
A retired admiral with a keen sense of our geopolitical moment sizes up the accord.
So what's occurred here is a coalescing of an Arab coalition against Iran. That's why this is a big deal.
And the violent unrest leads to a brutal police ambush in Los Angeles.
Investigators say that the man opened fire multiple times, striking the two deputies. Then the passenger door opens and the shooter can be seen running away.
A university remembers 9/11, 19 years after.
If you drive down Pacific Coast Highway, you are met as you drive by the big green front lawn, 3,000 flags.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join us now by video. And please follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. This week, the president, along with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the foreign ministers of two Gulf states, the United Arab Emirates and the Kingdom of Bahrain, stood together at the White House for a signing ceremony. Their countries had agreed to a deal to begin diplomatic and economic relations for the first time. The accord, known as the Abraham Accord, included not just diplomacy, but trade relations and military cooperation. It's an enormous reset for the region, one that will be counted as a milestone along with the Camp David Accords of 1978 and the Jordan-Israel Peace Treaty of 1994. Ironically, this deal was made in the shadow of Iran's continuing terrorist threats. National Security Advisor Ambassador Robert C. O'Brien was on my show the following morning. Congratulations on being there and being a part of a major pivot point, as Benjamin Netanyahu called it, in the history of Middle East peace.
It was really a day that demonstrated courage and highlighted the courage of King Hamad, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Zayed, and Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu, and the leadership of Donald J. Trump to bring them all together to reach this incredible deal.
3 days ago, Politico reported that Iran has threatened our ambassador to South Africa. 2 days ago, Admiral Stavridis said on this show that if they did so, the response ought to be immediate and massive. The president said, we're all set. If they do this, quote, they'll be hit 1,000 times harder. What's the message to the mullahs, Robert O'Brien?
Well, the message to the mullahs is don't make that mistake. And if you do, there will be a severe and decisive response. Alana Marks, a great ambassador to South Africa. She's a friend of the president, but this would apply to a friend of mine, but this would apply to any ambassador, not just Ambassador Marks. So, the days of state-sponsored terrorism by Iran are over. And if they engage in that kind of behavior, the consequences would be massive. Peace through strength works. It always has. It did from Roman times on. Ronald Reagan brought it back into fashion here. And President Trump, after 8 years of leading from behind, the deal that we have in the Middle East was built on political capital. So President Trump created political capital by moving the embassy to Jerusalem. He recognized the Golan Heights. On the Gulf Arab side, he sold them arms that they needed to defend themselves against Iran. He deployed Patriot missiles there. He pulled out of the disastrous JCPOA, which was just rank appeasement, and he built capital with the Gulf Arabs. But then he did something that was very unusual for politicians and presidents. He spent the political capital in Israel and in the Gulf states. He used that capital to get both sides to make tough decisions and make peace. And that's how you do a deal. And I think it's a case study. There are a lot of folks on the team. It's a highly accomplished team of Mark Meadows and Mike Pompeo and Gina Haspel and John Radcliffe. I mean, these are varsity players who came in and and showed how to execute the plays and quarterback by Donald Trump. But there's nothing worse for the out of power party, and I include a lot of the so-called Republicans in there who, you know, have just been wrong time and time and time again on foreign policy issues. He's kept us out of wars the same way Ronald Reagan kept us out of wars, by smart diplomacy and hard power and soft power combined to get wins for the United States.
Now, Ambassador O'Brien, the president hinted strongly yesterday that more Sunni countries will be joining this new pact for peace in the Middle East, including Saudi Arabia. How imminent is another addition to the Abraham Accord?
Well, look, we're talking to a number of folks. The president's been talking to leaders in the region on a regular basis, and you see those readouts in the White House statements, so people can start, you know, drawing their own conclusions from the foreign heads of state with whom he's speaking. These deals are all very complicated and hard. They're tough deals. They're complex negotiations. Even though we have a lot of momentum, it's tough sledding. It takes a lot of investing in personal relationships and figuring out how to match up the Israelis with their counterparts. And we're doing that on a daily basis. So I think we're going to have more success, as the president pointed out. You know, we don't have a timeline on this.
Retired Naval Admiral James Stavridis is a regular on my program. He's one of the brighter military and geopolitical analysts today, which one would expect from a former Supreme Allied Commander of NATO. And he's no stranger to the Middle East. He joined my program to brief us on the strategic gains resulting from this latest agreement. Why don't you give us a primer on both the UAE and Bahrain and what you think today means for the region?
Yeah, let's start with UAE, one of the Gulf states. It's actually composed, as the name of the country implies, United Arab Emirates. It's a group of smaller entities inside the Arabian Gulf, in the southeastern corner of the Arabian Gulf. They are highly capable nation. They have often played a leading role in Middle East politics, despite having a small population. And they have a very capable military, very concerned about the threat of Iran. So if you go just north in the Arabian Gulf is the island nation of Bahrain, has also a very small population, does not have the oil wealth and the natural gas wealth that the UAE does. Tends to follow in Arab politics in the wake of Saudi Arabia, of course, but also of the UAE. So what's occurred here is a coalescing of a nascent but growing Arab coalition against Iran that incorporates Israel. That's why this is a big deal, because these are the first two Arab states other than Jordan and Egypt, who many years ago, during the Camp David Accords, of course, signed up to recognize Israel. Now you're finally seeing the Gulf Arab states, which is where the money is, all the wealth, the oil, the natural gas, and the military capability, all that coming together against Iran.
Bahrain and UAE both have logistical capability and shipping capabilities, which are central. And then something I didn't know, UAE financial depth is not unlike Wall Street in terms of banking, and they lead in clean energy. So I think the Israeli-UAE highway is going to run in two directions, not just capital from UAE into Israel, but innovation from UAE into Israel, and both of those back again. Agree, Admiral?
Without question. And by the way, let's also point out that Bahrain hosts the U.S. Fifth Fleet. So as you know, Hugh, around the world, we have these so-called numbered fleets. The one that is the largest fleet is the Fifth Fleet. So we, the United States, are already extremely close to Bahrain. Now, to your point, that flow of technology is also one of military capability. So watch for Israel and UAE in particular to work together on intelligence sharing, all of it directed against Iran.
Do you think the Palestinians say it's time to grow rather than sow discord? It's time to make a deal rather than refuse to sit down. Is that going to happen?
It is. And again, this is important, not because UAE and Bahrain per se have recognized Israel or are about to. They're relatively small states. What's important here is the potential for commerce, for innovation, for military cooperation, broadly speaking, between the Sunni Arab world and Israel. That's profound, and it will have impact. The one to watch, obviously, is the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. But watch for Morocco and Sudan, both of whom have Sunni Arab connections and populations, to make the next step. I think following that, the gravitas of this, the throw weight of it, has increased to the point the kingdom will probably make that decision sooner rather than later.
This past Sunday, we were met with some shocking news. Two sheriff deputies were shot, critically injured, while sitting in their patrol car outside a metro station in Compton, California. My colleague Larry Elder, who is based in L.A., brought the news report onto his show the following day.
We have to talk about two L.A. sheriff deputies who were shot in the head, ambush style, as they sat in their patrol cars.
Manhunt is on right now for the shooter that the L.A. County Sheriff's Department says ambushed two of its deputies. All of this happening just down the street from us. This is East Palmer. The shooting happened down that way. It is only just a few blocks from the Compton Sheriff's Station. You can see a man wearing dark clothing and what appears to be a ball cap walk up to the passenger side of a parked black and white unit from the Sheriff's Station. Investigators say that the man opened fire multiple times, striking the two deputies. Then the passenger door opens and the shooter can be seen running away.
Black Lives Matter protesters swarmed the hospital where these deputies were taken, I kid you not, chanting. One of them said, I hope the B word dies, referring to the 30-year-old mother sheriff deputy. I hope the B word dies. By the way, the female deputy and the 24-year-old male who was with her both graduated from the academy 14 months ago, according to the sheriff. Video posted online showed Black Lives Matter protesters being stopped from walking further onto the hospital grounds and arguing with hospital security over whether the hospital is public or private property. One of them said, and I'm quoting, "Y'all gonna die one by one. This ain't gonna stop." Another said, I want to deliver a message to the family of the pigs. I hope they effing die." I keep waiting for one of these athletes, in the wake of people protesting and kneeling and doing demonstrations on the fields, on the football field and basketball fields, is there going to be somebody with credibility, somebody other than Herschel Walker? Because you can't, I use him because he's a Trump guy. I've known Trump 37 years, so he's in a whole different category, right? Is there some athlete that is respected by the current athletes, either a current ball player or a former ball player, whether it's Charles Barkley or, I don't know, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who writes a column, by the way, for Time magazine, gives his thoughts about society, about all sorts of issues? Will one of these guys, one of the guys, take the time to examine the data like you examine game film? Look at the studies, and you will find that the police are not killing black people because they're black. It's a lie.
Coming up.
If you drive down Pacific Coast Highway, you are met as you drive by the big green front lawn, 3,000 flags.
9/11 refuses to be forgotten in Malibu. The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. September 11, 2001 is forever etched in the memory of those who watched it unfold on a brilliant late summer morning in New York City. An attack planned by al-Qaeda, an Islamist group, hijacked four American airliners. Two of those planes took out the Twin Towers in Lower Manhattan. Another simultaneously slammed into the Pentagon at Washington, D.C., and a fourth airliner, bound for D.C., is now referred to simply as Flight 93. It was forced down by its own brave passengers in rural Pennsylvania. It's a day etched in my memory as I was broadcasting live as events unfolded.
American Airlines is confirming that its Flight 11 from Boston to Los Angeles was hijacked today, and that its plane was the first one involved in this attack on the World Trade Center.
The central fact of the morning is that thousands of Americans have been killed by a terrorist attack, and the repercussions will reverberate for for decades to come.
Pete Peterson, dean of the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, was actually in New York City on 9/11. Dean Peterson was the guest of my colleague Seth Leibson on AM 960 The Patriot in Phoenix.
This is just one of those days. You've just got to feel what needs to be felt.
You have students in your school. You have students at Pepperdine who know nothing of it from firsthand, right? That have only the stories we tell are the stories that the culture tells. And you at Pepperdine do something important here. Unlike a lot of schools, places of higher education, you have something of the waves of flags. Do you want to tell us about that? Is that a good place to start?
Yeah, no, it is. It's actually one of the many evidences of God's work in my life is that I was in New York on that fateful day and now work in an institution 3,000 miles away that I think commemorates 9/11 more poignantly than any school.
That's my sense. I mean, I was looking into this waves of flags. Yeah, you bet. I think you're right.
It started with a group of college Republicans and some folks from Young America's Freedom Foundation with a proposal soon after 9/11 to say, would it be possible to put flags commemorating each one who we lost on that day? And that's where it began, and now we've been doing it now for over, I think we were 16 years now. Obviously, today's the 19th anniversary, but I think we've been at it 15 or 16 years. Yeah. And if you drive down Pacific Coast Highway, you are met as you drive by the big green front lawn of the Pepperdine campus.
I know it well.
3,000 flags.
3,000 flags.
Yeah.
3,000 flags. Fantastic. I'll tell you, I was worried early on. Why don't you do your story? Because I know 9/11 changed you. Why don't you do yours, and then I'll tell you what I was worried about on that day. You were in New York. I was in Washington.
Yeah, I was working at a marketing advertising firm at 38th Street and 8th Avenue, commuted in from New Jersey, the suburbs where I was living, and got a phone call in the office soon after the first plane hit from one of the other staff members. It was a fairly small firm, but he lived across the street from the towers. And he's calling in just frantically saying, I'm not coming into the office. A plane has just hit the World Trade Center. But you know, didn't really think too much of it. And then he calls back about 45 minutes or so later to say a second plane has hit and you've got to turn on the television.
Yeah.
And so sure enough, as soon as that second plane hit, all the phones were lit up, and we're seeing now on the internet what's happening. And the president of this marketing firm just said, you know, that old last call, you don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. And I said, Alan, can I crash at your place? Because I can't, there's no place for me to go. And I made the walk, maybe an hour and a half it took to go from 38th and 8th up to 89th. And it was just an amazing walk, right? I'm walking along and cars are coming up from downtown with sheetrock and white dust just falling off of them, you know, and people lined up at payphones because none of the cell phones were working, trying to communicate with people, telling them it's okay. All the while you're looking downtown and you're seeing this pall of brown black smoke that's just coming spilling into the air. And so I managed to get to his apartment and turned on the news and just stared at the television for 3 hours.
Right.
And so I left the apartment, walked out into Central Park only a few blocks away, and again it was that perfect day that everybody describes. You look uptown, kids and baby strollers and parents and people walking around, and then you look downtown at the smoke and you realize that the world's changing and you're not sure how.
Peter Schweitzer is an author, political consultant, and is always controversial. His latest project is a movie about the Bidens. It's called Riding the Dragon. So far, so good until you hear the primary topic, the Bidens' deal-making with foreign governments while Joe Biden was vice president in the Obama administration. Peter was a guest of my Salem colleague, Sebastian Gorka.
Explain to us why this movie and why the Bidens.
Well, I think this movie is important because, you know, books are wonderful. I've devoted my life to writing books. You've written books. But there's a certain part of the population that doesn't read books or they don't read serious nonfiction books. So I wanted to reach a larger audience. And I felt it was necessary in conjunction with this film company to put together a film that laid out the details. And what I see is really one of the most remarkable and shocking acts of corruption that I've seen. What the Bidens have done with regards to China stands out to me as perhaps the most shocking of all the forms of corruption that I've seen.
But why? Because, you know, the good thing about your work, and you're absolutely right, whether it's this book or your previous books, is that you call, you know, balls and strikes on both sides, whether it's Mitch McConnell's connections with China, whether it's Republican malfeasance, or whether it's the Clintons and Clinton cash. You call it on both sides. So why is this so shocking? And if you're shocked, average Americans should be even more horrified. Explain to us why.
Well, I think for a couple of reasons, Seb. First of all, the Bidens have done a series of deals with the Chinese government, which is our chief rival on the global stage. There's no question that the biggest threat to the United States today is China. China is the one power on the global stage that wants to supplant us, that wants to replace us, that wants to challenge all our military supremacy. So that's the first thing. This commercial relationship that the Bidens formed is with that country. China does not wish us well. The second part that's so shocking is the blatant nature of it and the naked nature of it. And what I mean by that is they signed a series of deals with the Chinese government, but that by any stretch of the imagination, they had no expertise, they had no backgrounds, they don't bring anything to the table. And then the final part, I guess, the final ingredient is that said, this is not just, you know, okay, the Bidens made money. That's bad enough. These deals actually benefited the Chinese strategic position. Hunter Biden sat on the board of a Chinese-funded investment fund that went around buying companies that benefited the Chinese military in their competition with the United States.
Coming up.
The Swedish strategy was always about a recognition of the fact that we cannot avoid it completely.
When will our nation open up again? When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Johan Norberg is a Swedish author and historian and is known for his book, In Defense of Global Capitalism. Among today's elites, he already has two strikes against him. First, Sweden did not shut down during the COVID pandemic. Two, he is a global capitalist and proud of it. Johan was a recent guest of Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer in Chicago.
Will society ever open up again? I don't know. How optimistic are you? I'm not terribly.
No, that's the question, because what is the metrics? It keeps changing all the time. Originally, they said that they had to shut everything down just to give the healthcare system time to cope with it. But once that was done, it was more vaguely flattening the curve. But when that's done, it seems like the whole point is that we should just avoid cases and deaths entirely. The Swedish strategy was always about was a recognition of the fact that we cannot avoid it completely. We can postpone it. We can delay cases and deaths by lockdowns. But then when you get out of it, you'll see the same thing happening again. And no one can stay down in lockdown forever or until we have a vaccine, because that would destroy the economy, the social fabric of society, the education system, mental health. And so on and so on.
And by the way, that's exactly what we've seen in Western Europe, Sweden versus Spain, France, and other Western European countries, where they have had outbreaks. Now Israel is doing a second lockdown. We saw the same thing in July with certain states here. But then you're 6 weeks removed from it, as we are now with some of those states that saw spikes in July. And you start to say, well, maybe Sweden did have it right all the time with their light touch when it came to these mandates that are sort of ascientific and particularly draconian.
That's right. And it also, the Swedish model gave some room for common sense and for people to use their own individual judgment on social distancing, on protecting vulnerable people and so on. And we can continue to say that and move that back and forth when we need more social distancing. But if you choose this repressive lockdown, it's either you go back in total or you just leave it be. But with the metrics they have, that we should keep it under, keep it suppressed, keep COVID-19 suppressed, then they will have to go back into lockdowns again and delayed perhaps a little bit further, but with even more damage to society and to our kids and families. So I think it's a very dangerous strategy.
Well, one metric that, that was given, it was Governor Cuomo did say if they have a positivity rate under 2% for 2 weeks or more, that he would open up schools for in-person learning. And they are going to do that. But of course, now people are pushing back. And I was wondering, because I've been asking friends from Poland and from Serbia, like, what is life like there? We seem to be the only country in the world where teachers are afraid to go back to class to teach.
Isn't this, it's a bit strange, because this is the one area where there seems to be, if not consensus, at least a strong majority opinion among researchers, that schools should be open because the damage to kids is so great, but also the children don't seem to spread the virus as much as elders do and adults do. And therefore, that should be open. And many countries have regretted that they backed away from that and shut down the schools. Now it seems like it's more politics than science here. And that's why I don't know when you get out the moment you have created that that fear of going back to school.
Interesting, though, this journal piece about where we stand with the job situation in America. 6.6 million job openings in July, about as many as we had in December of last year. Also in the retail sector, despite a lot of brick and mortar store bankruptcies, you have retailers, online retailers, warehouses, home improvement stores like Home Depot that have been on a hiring binge. So retail workers' wages have actually risen at an annualized rate of 10% since February. And though we still have about 2.5 unemployed workers for each job opening, that's the same ratio we had in January of 14, 5 years after the Great Recession of 08-09. So it is a curious thing, despite these major cities in America being more or less offline, you really do have a bounce back when at least as it pertains to employment.
Yeah, and I think you should have, because there's lots of pent up demand. People have been saving lots of money during this period. Now they're getting back in, if not full force, at least some of it. And we can see sectors of the economy, as you say, growing rapidly. And then obviously you need people.
Coming up, how does it feel to be in the company of our president every day for over 2 years?
I've never seen a group of people like the far left. Certainly we have people on the far right that are very intense, very focused on their message. But the far left, like you said, is so angry.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. This COVID-19 crisis has been straining the limits of our constitutional system. Over the next few years, we'll see a generation of new and grounded policy leaders emerge. They'll be prepared at Pepperdine's Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more about the deadline for application at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the daughter of former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee, has been around politics for a long time. Not only that, she was around Donald Trump both during his campaign and for more than 3 years in the administration. She stepped aside from her role as White House press secretary in 2019, has been busy with what you might expect, helping to raise her three children. She's also been doing some speaking recently, and she's written a book, the title, Speaking for Myself, Faith, Freedom, and the Fight of Our Lives Inside the Trump White House. She was a recent guest of my colleague, Dennis Prager.
What do you think of the press as people?
Well, I think that the press plays a very important role in society. Unfortunately, I think they have cheapened that role by making so much of their job to attack the president instead of to report the news. So often, the lines have become completely blurred between news and opinion.
When you served as press secretary, did you expect better?
I definitely was surprised. I certainly knew that there would be tension. There's always been tension between the White House press corps and the administration. However, the level of vitriol was different. The discourse was different. Even when we were traveling, I'll never forget, we were in another country, a country that's very used to, I don't want to out this individual, but the communications director for a European country that's used to dealing with the press said, "I've never seen anything like this." He said, "The difference between how they treat President Trump and how they treat President Obama is night and day. This is insane. I've never seen a press corps act like this."
How would you rank the worstitude?
I would definitely put CNN at the top of that list as the worst. They decided that they no longer wanted to be a news organization, but they wanted to be an attack dog for the Democrat Party, for the liberal elites, and that is what they have done. I think they decided they hated this president more than they love this country, and they spend every single day, no matter how good things are going, attacking him. That doesn't mean that on occasion you don't have a couple of people on CNN who try to make the other side, try to make the other point. But by and large, I think they're one of the worst as a whole as an outlet.
Did you ever socialize with any of these people?
Certainly. I mean, we spent a lot of our days together. I mean, that's one of the points I write about in my book. In particular, ahead of the correspondence dinner, the people that were in the room, Michelle Wolf excluded, we all knew each other. They knew me. I spent almost every day working back and forth with these people. I knew their hobbies. I knew their family stories. They knew mine. I wasn't the outsider in that moment. And there's certainly some collegial moments that take place because you're traveling together. You're spending so much time working together that you have those moments. And I try to paint that picture as well. But I was not the outsider that came into that room, which was another reason that moment was so disheartening, is I was their invited guest sitting at that head table, only to be mocked at the worst way possible by another woman for my appearance, for my makeup, everything. And, you know, to be in front of people that I considered in large part my colleagues was, again, very frustrating and very disheartening.
Yeah, you will never get this question from anyone else. I'm warning you in advance. But in light of what you just said, and my listeners know that I have a theory on this, there's a lot of meanness on the left. So I ask myself, and now I'm asking you, do you think that mean people gravitate left? Or left makes decent people mean?
That may be one of the hardest questions I've had. And I wouldn't have expected my hardest question to come from somebody who I usually align with. But, you know, I think that they are so focused on the destruction of people. And it's all in the name of tolerance. As long as you agree with them. I've never seen a group of people like the far left. Certainly we have people on the far right that are very intense, very focused on their message. But the far left, like you said, is so angry and so negative that they are willing to burn cities to the ground, willing to see innocent people hurt, all in the name of getting their message out there. And I find it, again, a very sad place in America. I think it's one of the reasons this election is so important, so consequential, is that we are at a crossroads of either continuing as a country of safety and security and prosperity, or we're going to move to the left under Joe Biden. And not even necessarily because he's so far radical, although I think he is, but because he's so afraid to stand up to the people that are. And if we don't have somebody in that place that's willing to take on that negativity, willing to take on that anger, that we have in President Trump, I'm very afraid of what America looks like if they get control and they get to continue to bully Americans from coast to coast.
How well did you know President Trump prior to being appointed?
You know, I'd gotten to know him a little bit. We first met in 2015, actually, when my dad was running against him, and spent some time with him at some of the debates and the cattle call events where all of the candidates gathered together, and got to know him a little bit there, and a lot more in 2016 once I joined his campaign. But I hadn't spent a significant amount of time with him until I started in the White House. And pretty early on, even as the deputy press secretary, got to spend quite a bit around the time around the president in those early days. And certainly once becoming the press secretary, almost every single day for a little over 2 years, I was either with him or talking to him by phone and communicating with him in some way. So quite a bit of time over the course of the 3.5 years I worked for him. He is a very engaging, charismatic, fun person to be around. I think the person that you see at the president's rallies where he's entertaining and telling stories and telling a very specific and direct message to his audience is very much what he's like behind the scenes. But I also got to see the softer side of the president when I sat in the Oval Office with him as he made condolence calls to families who had lost a son in Afghanistan, or when I traveled with him all over the world. I went to more than 20 countries with the president and sat at the table with him while he was negotiating with world leaders. So I got to see those different moments as well. And what I saw was somebody who loves this country, is fighting ferociously for America.
For more of Dennis's conversation with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
We believe that every human life is made in the image of God. If we could ever get back to that, I think our culture will be faring far better.
Protecting the unborn in New York City, when we return with the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, Trump shepherds historic Middle East peace agreement.
To have that change overnight is magical.
And was nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize.
People have gotten Nobel Prizes for negotiating between Israel and the Arabs. It seems to me that everyone involved in this should get a Nobel Prize as well.
Hashtag cancel Netflix trends after they air a show sexualizing children.
These 11-year-old, 12-year-old actresses that actually starred in the movie were being asked to do things that no child should be asked to do. Certainly not for the sake of entertainment.
And a look at a deeper problem.
These things are examples of one of our culture's most insidious evils. How we steal childhood in the name of sexual progress.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Focus on the Family has been coming alongside families for a long time. It's impossible to calculate how many families have been assisted through the Focus team of counselors through its international broadcast ministry. Focus has also been standing up for the unborn in places like Times Square, New York City. Jim Daly, president of Focus on the Family, spoke with Dennis Prager about another huge event happening soon.
Why don't you describe what you want to tell my listeners?
Sure. You know, last year in May, right there in Times Square, we did a big event. We had 20,000, the largest pro-life event in New York City's history. The New York Times decided not to cover it, even though we were only a block away. But it was awesome. We had about 20,000 people that joined us, 400 protesters. We got to the point where Alveda King, Christina Bennett, Benjamin Watson, all African Americans, got on stage and said more black babies were killed in New York City by Planned Parenthood last year than were born. And the most successful thing about that event was the Black Lives Matter folks who threw their signs down and joined us. I thought, there's a light bulb that went off. And so we're coming back September 26th, right around the corner. We're doing a virtual one-hour presentation with great speakers, great music, and also a live 4D third trimester ultrasound of a child in the womb, which our thesis is simple. Let's show them the baby, and then they can try to debate why it's not a baby.
I want you to know how important I consider what you said about the third trimester video. I would trade the following. I would say, you know what? We're going to leave legislation the way it is. If you allow legislation that every woman who gets an abortion sees a video, most women do not know who get an abortion do not know what they are doing fully.
Correct. Yeah, and I don't think, Dennis, that's an unrealistic incremental approach. More than 50% of abortion-minded women, when they actually see the ultrasound, if they get an ultrasound, will choose life for the baby, because I think they get it when they see the picture and they see the baby inside of them. It's, you know, again, the abortion industry does so much to obfuscate what is truth in that reality. And I think showing people the baby is the key. And human life needs protection, and we're seeing it. I think much of what you're talking about, I'm sure today, whether it's the shootings in Compton or other things, this is all linked. When we begin as a culture to disregard life, whether it's in the womb or outside of the womb, it's a slippery slope to discarding all life, whether it's breathing or in the womb still. And I think that's the big problem we're facing as a culture today. We believe that every human life is made in the image of God, and that's why we need to protect it as a culture, left, right, and center. No debate. And if we could ever get back to that, I think our culture will be faring far better.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richards, David Posian, Michael Cook, Alex Perez, Ben Brigman, Carly Eady, and Dwayne Patterson. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.